Hey guys, this week's podcast episode is sponsored by my friends Ilana and Guy Azran in memory of Ilana's parents, Betsy and George Kaplan. And, you know, I like to tell you guys a little bit about the people who the podcasts are in honor of or memory of or just who it's being dedicated to. So Betsy and George Kaplan are originally from New York, but they met in Atlanta, Georgia, where they were married, and they were some of the first congregants of Rabbi Emanuel Feldman Shul Beth Jacob. If you guys are not familiar with this, Rabbi Feldman is a pretty well-known rabbi. I highly suggest reading his book, Tales Out of Shul. It was a really good book. After raising their four children, they moved to Israel in 1989, where they lived a very active life, learning, volunteering, and traveling. Here, two of their married daughters chose to settle, and they have several grandchildren and some great-grandchildren as well. And I have known Betsy and George Kaplan, or I knew Betsy and George Kaplan most of my life. My family is originally from Atlanta, Georgia. Alana and I have been friends since we were in third grade. I mean, I hate to sound like one of, you know, like I'm 95 years old, but the first time I ever took the bus by myself in Atlanta, it was with Alana. We took the bus to the mall, and that ride cost us 10 cents. So I feel like I was born in, I don't know, a long, 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 long time ago to be able to say that I remember when the bus cost 10 cents, but I do. And one of the things I remember about them is they both really had great senses of humor. They were a lot of fun. They were truly nice and wonderful people. Even after they moved to Israel, before they sold their house, and even once I went back to the States, before I had a permanent place where I was settled, their house was always open to people from Israel who were traveling back to the States. I stayed there myself a couple of times, and they were just really fun, really incredible people. And Betsy only died a few years ago. I think it was during the first year of COVID. It might have been 2021, might have been 2020 or 2021. I don't remember exactly when. And I would say George passed away probably about 12 or 13 years before that. But they were just a really, you know, incredible, one of these like power couples from like Atlanta, one of the, you know, kind of one of these, like, you know, like Alana said, one of the original families of Beth Jacob, and everybody kind of knew who they were. And they were just, you know, really, really wonderful people. And this podcast should just be dedicated in their memory, that their neshamot should have an aliyah. And thank you. I want to thank you, Alana and Guy, for sponsoring this week's episode. So I'm excited to bring you guys this episode. I recorded this with Dr. Hazen. I don't remember exactly when, but I'm going to say probably the beginning of September, before the beginning of the war. This was something that I heard about a few years ago, fecal transplant, and I just found it fascinating. And I hope that Dr. Hazen doesn't mind that I have attached an interview with Saffron Cassidy as well, the director and producer of the film Designer Shit, because, you know, I don't think that Dr. Hazen would recommend self-home treatment for fecal transplant, but it was really interesting to hear Saffron's story and, you know, why she chose to do this and how badly she suffered. And I know with all of the research that Dr. Hazen continues to do in this area, I'm sure that this is a treatment that will be available, I hope, in the coming years to many, many people who really are suffering as well. So I hope you guys will enjoy this episode. If anybody is interested in sponsoring a future episode, please contact me. I'm sure you guys can find me on Instagram, the website. A lot of you have my WhatsApp number, whatever. Please just let me know and help us continue to keep putting out this interesting information. And if anybody has a charitable organization or some type of an event they would like me to talk about, I'm happy to do that as well. I know we have listeners all over the world. So, you know, anybody feel free, please, to reach out to me. Or if there is, you know, just a charitable organization that you'd like me to talk about, please feel free to reach out. And thanks for your feedback. I love getting it from you guys. And I hope you'll enjoy this episode as much as any of the others. Shabbat shalom. And we should hear Bisarot Tovot and only good things. May this war come to a swift end, and may God watch out for all of our soldiers and all of our citizens.
You're listening to Holy Health, the podcast that brings you the latest in health ideas and technology across the spectrum of fields. While ultimately our fate is up to God, how we get there is determined by us. As it says in Qohelet, there is nothing new under the sun. We get that everything can be found in Torah. Our goal is to empower you with knowledge that may help you make better lifestyle choices. This podcast has been brought to you by Musach Haguf Physical Therapy and Personal Training Studio. Our motto is fixing the past in order to build the future. You can find us on Instagram at Musach Haguf.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Holy Health. My guest today is Dr. Sabine Hazen. Dr. Hazen was the first woman accepted into the University of Florida as a clinical gastroenterology fellow. She's a pioneer in the medical field. She's published numerous articles in prestigious medical journals and is the series editor on the microbiome for Practical Gastroenterology, a peer-reviewed journal that reaches 18,000 gastroenterologists. She's also the speaker for the World Congress of Digestive Disease, MAGI, Microbiome Congress, ILADS, TACA, International Drug Discovery Science and Technology Conference, and the National Institute of Standards and Technology. As a specialist in gastroenterology, internal medicine, and hepatology, Dr. Hazen has used her medical expertise in many regards over the last two decades. She's the CEO of Ventura Clinical Trials, where she has 20 plus years experience leading clinical trials for cutting edge research on various medical issues and has done over 300 clinical trials for pharmaceutical companies. Since March of 2020, she's been at the forefront of COVID-19 research, leading ongoing FDA-approved clinical trials for treatment and prophylaxis on hydroxychloroquine, Z-Pak, vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, and ivermectin. She's also the founder and CEO of ProgenaBiome, a genetic sequencing research laboratory. She leads 35 plus studies investigating the role of the gut flora in various diseases. Through their study exploring the role of the gut flora in COVID-19, ProgenaBiome became the first lab worldwide to detect SARS-CoV-2 from patient fecal samples by whole genome sequencing and the lab that showed a susceptibility marker for COVID in the microbiome. Dr. Hazen is mastering familial fecal transplant, showing hope for kids with autism. She created the Malibu Microbiome Meeting, where physicians who perform fecal transplant can discuss their findings freely. And she's done more than that, too. That was like a shortened version of a bunch of bios that I found. So first of all, I want to welcome you and thank you so much. I know your time is limited, and I'm really excited to speak to you.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. So there are so many things we could talk about. Some of the things that only recently, as I started looking over your Instagram account, but I know we can also tie this into what I wanted to speak about today, which was really fecal transplant.
Sure.
So
yeah, so fecal transplant is an exciting, new technology, I think, but it's not really new because it comes from like 5th century China. And then Dr. Einsman in 1958 kind of revived it with two fleet enemas in patients with C. diff. And then Dr. Barodi, Dr. Stolman, Dr. Kelly, so many doctors kind of like stepped into it and said, let's see what putting poop in patients does to patients with chronic UTI, with autism, with Alzheimer's, with alopecia areata. Let's just see. Of course, we're at the beginning of the technology, looking at it. I don't believe it's a pharmaceutical product. I believe it's really precision medicine, but we shall see. The future is to be discovered.
Okay. So we're speaking to an audience who they're not physicians. They're not necessarily health professionals. Could you actually explain what a fecal transplant actually is and how you do it?
So hopefully my mom's not listening to this because she doesn't like to remember that I'm doing, that I'm playing with poop, because she really raised me really sterile and clean, which could have been a problem too in retrospect. So fecal transplant is essentially taking stools from a healthy donor. They give it to us in a container. We put it in a blender with some, purified water, blend it, and then take it and put it in the cecum of the patient. So the patient has Clostridium difficile. So we take that syringe and we basically implant it directly into the cecum after we do a bunch of things to clean the colon, the biofilm, etc. And then essentially we hope that the patient doesn't have, turbulence in his colon and turbulence in his life. and that implantation and what we call engraftment occurs. So the process of engraftment is really taking a stool specimen from one patient, putting it into the other patient, and then matching the donor in a way. So all of a sudden, your fingerprint of your microbiome that was a certain way, like let's say you had, I don't know, bifidobacteria. Well, let's say you didn't have bifidobacteria, but let's say you had ruminococcus and, you know, Firmicutes and Bacteroides. And then all of a sudden I'm giving you a group of microbes that is, you know, good microbes. You change your formula to that donor. And in essence, what we've observed when we do it right and when engraftment occurs, we've observed certain little things like patient that was depressed became happy because the donor was happy. Person that was suicidal, no longer suicidal because the donor was not suicidal. Person that was that had alopecia areata, two cases from Dr. Colleen Kelly, grew hair. So, of course, you know, people look at that and they go, it becomes like the gold rush, right? I was recently writing an article and I call this the gold rush of the fecal transplant, right? Of the microbiome. Everybody wants to do it. Everybody wants to be that doctor that's, you know, changing, that's growing hair, right? But when you look at the data and you look at other doctors doing it, they're not really reproducing what we see in those N of one or N of two. So what is going on when scientists or doctors on the front line are doing something to patients with C. diff, and then they're giving stool transplant, and then next thing you know, something is happening for two patients, but it's not happening for the rest. You have to start asking the questions, right? Is it the donor? Is it the colon that's not accepting those microbes? Is it the environment that's basically bringing on so much toxins that even though you give them a good microbiome, it's not engrafting, right? So there's so many questions that we have. So we need to fine tune this process. I'll tell you, you know, those are, it's crazy because I don't learn from the cases that I succeed. Like I had a patient that had Alzheimer's. I gave him his wife's poop. He had C. diff and Alzheimer's. I gave him his wife's poop. And all of a sudden, he remembered his daughter's date of birth, right? So I learned something with his microbiome, looking at what changed, etc. But, you know, did I learn enough to say, okay, this is exactly what I need to do for the next patient? Maybe that's why we need to do testing. But I'll tell you where I learned the most. Yes, this gave me a light. This gave me a hope. But here's where I learned the most. I learned the most from the failed experiments. In other words, the fecal transplant that didn't grasp, right? I had a guy the other day, he was in a rush to do fecal transplant. I told him, I said, look, I don't think this is your right donor. We're going to use the bank, but you know, you're taking a chance. I don't know if it's going to work, right? So I used the bank. It worked for about 5 days. Where he was back to normal. And then on day six, he's miserable again. Here's a case that obsesses me at night, right? Because I'm like, what went wrong? Is it the donor? Because the donor was spectacular, right? Is it the recipient? Is it the colon? Is it that he came from, you know, a different country to America and therefore he's not really matching my American native patient? Is it his microbiome? Is it the stress? Is it the environment that killed what I gave him? You know, what is it? So I'm like, you know, every day, and I'm on a text with this patient, mainly because this is no longer, you know, medicine. This is, I don't like failures. I like to succeed. So I'm like, no, we're going to keep doing this until we figure it out, until I fix you back to normal, right? So, but every patient, it takes a long time. It's time consuming. It's, you know, it really becomes a patient-doctor relationship. That's why I don't take everybody. You know, I'm really like, you know, who's going to work with me? Who's going to understand this is research? Who's going to sign a consent because it's research? So, you know, this is the abyss of fecal transplant. So we have a lot to learn, a lot.
So first off, I love what you said. You probably saw me like smiling and nodding. because, you know, I'm a physical therapist. I've studied many different modalities, many different ways. I'm a big believer. I don't fix anybody. I help people fix themselves. And I always say the same thing. You learn the most through failure. When you try something and you don't get it, that's actually when your brain learns. The same way a baby. So I loved when you said that. I was just like, oh my gosh, I love it.
Well, there's a physician that used to, for every mistakes that he made, he would put lanterns in his backyard, right, to remind himself of all the mistakes. So I think we have to be humble to realize we're stepping into something that's new, and we need to understand how it's done, and we need to do the research properly. You know, it's kind of funny because I go into the spaces of Twitter and Instagram. And I really, really try not to give people advice, because it's not a one pill fits all. It's not a one solution. But I love when people, like, you know, something worked for them, and then all of a sudden they're the experts because it worked for them. And I always have to remind them, I'm like, just because it worked for you doesn't mean that you should influence others to use that, right? Great, you know, melatonin helps you sleep, but how many people it doesn't help sleep, right? And how many people does it hurt, right? So we can't really be that patient, that doctor that influences everyone to do the same thing for everyone. It's a big mistake. We're all different. We all have different fingerprints. We all have different microbiomes. What makes us think that we're going to be, you know, taking the same formula? You know, especially in the microbiome space, right? The microbiome is trillions of microbes, and we're all different. There is not one human on this planet that has the same identical microbiome. That's it, because we all have traveled different places. We've accumulated certain microbes. We were born in certain places that had certain microbes. Think about the guy in Mexico who drinks the water, doesn't get Giardia, and then the girl from California who goes to Mexico and gets Giardia. Vice versa, the guy that lives on a pond where the ducks are having their bowel movements and is washing their vegetables in that pond with the ducks and is exposed to that microbiome of the ducks, he's fine. He doesn't have diarrhea, but yet the little American girl that goes there, you know, eats the tomatoes that were washed in that pond and gets diarrhea for 2 weeks, you know? We all have a different microbiome. Same thing with, you know, the Amazon jungle, right? Those people that are in the Amazon jungle are native to the Amazon jungle. They're part of the environment. They're part of the microbiome. They're part of the ecosystem. You get them out of that ecosystem, you get them into America, they lose all their diversity. They are not going to necessarily survive. Vice versa. An American person that lives in a sterile environment, you know, that is not, you know, exposed to mosquitoes, that is not exposed to bugs, will go to the Amazon jungle and probably get sick, right? Because it's adaptation. And adaptation is a funny thing. It's a gradual process. It's, you know, resilience that builds in. And here we are, we're trying to, like, make the whole planet into this vacuum. You know, pretty soon we're going to put a globe over the planet because people are so obsessed about sterility. You can't live in a bubble. You can't live in a glass container. You can't grow a fruit tree in a glass container. Maybe for a little bit if you put the right soil, but eventually it needs oxygen. It needs water. It needs vitamin D. It needs bugs. It needs, you know, life, right? You know?
Right. So. No, listen, I let my babies, when they were babies, crawl on the floor, play in the dirt. You know, I always let them do all of that because I used to joke, I'm like, it builds immunity, you know, but.
And same thing with me. Like the first child, I was super sterile with her, and then she was allergic to every antibiotic. Second one, I was like, go in the dirt, eat from the floor. I don't care. I go. And you know what? She was fine. She never took antibiotics. So, you know, kids in the garden, same thing, right? They go play in the garden and they have less ear infections. That data is very clear. You know, kindergartens that take their kids out to play in the ground, in the grass, they're not sick. They're exposed to the environment.
Okay, well, so that I didn't know about. That's really interesting. So I want to back up for 1 second. If I'm not mistaken, and I could totally be wrong about this, is the only use or the only time fecal transplant is like FDA approved right now is in cases of C. diff. And can you explain to people what C. diff is? I always explain it as explosive diarrhea, but like, I know it's the bacteria.
So, you know, there's explosive diarrhea, but there's also people that have just diarrhea and actually it's C. diff. So, C. diff is a bacteria. Clostridium difficile, by the terminology, it's a difficult bacteria to treat. Essentially, when you give people antibiotics, and that's what we've come to realize, you give people antibiotics, you kill that microbe, that's strep pneumonia, you kill that infection that you got, that UTI. But then what happens is you kill the rest of the microbiome. And so if you don't reboost the microbiome, and thus the whole motion and the whole vision of probiotics, right? They did a study where they basically were giving probiotics and they were improving C. diff. So that's when the whole mission, when we started our genetic sequencing of patients with C. diff, and remember my path, my history is I tried to kill C. diff for 30 years practically. I mean, I was doing clinical trials since the beginning at University of Florida. And then when C. diff became, higher cases, when we started seeing higher cases, I started doing a lot more clinical trials. And when these clinical trials didn't work, I would do fecal transplant on my patients because that worked. And 92 to 99% of the time, it worked, okay? There's always that one case. This was my one case this week with this patient. But of course, I fixed C. diff. I just didn't fix the other problems he wanted to fix. So when you're trying to fix C. diff, you know, it's very, very successful. Whether you do a pill, whether you do an enema, whether you put it in the colon, you know, the success rate from colon all the way to the cecum is quoted as 92%. Some people say 99%. So 92 to 99% if you go to the cecum. If you go to the rectum, it's 82 to 88%. So it's, you know, as a sigmoid, as an enema. Thus, the whole pharmaceutical movement of bringing fleet enemas as poop products, essentially. So when fecal transplant started showing more, that's when we really started seeing, hey, what else is going on there with feces, right? But what we've come to realize in our lab, especially because I was doing before and after testing of my fecal transplant, is we realized that people with C. diff were really lacking a diversity. Not only were they lacking a diversity, first of all, everyone has a fingerprint of C. diff in their gut, but it's not secreting toxins. So why is it that some people have, everybody has C. diff in their gut, and don't have chronic, and don't have diarrhea, and some people have diarrhea? Well, the difference is in the loss of diversity. When you look at a person with C. diff and you've given them all these antibiotics, you've killed their diversity, you've killed their microbiome. Especially with vancomycin, you're pretty much trashing the whole gut, right? So yes, that's a simple fix if you achieve to kill everything, but then the problem is now you have a gut that's empty of good microbes, and now you're at risk for other things like viruses, other bacteria with toxins, etc. So the domino effect continues. So what we noticed with C. diff is really that loss of diversity. That was really the beginning, the problem. And then what we did when we did fecal transplant is we took that diverse microbiome and we just implanted it. And that's really what was helping these patients with C. diff. So that was a real, you know, opening to the world of fecal transplant, where for the first time we're able to see, okay, well, the answer is not killing these microbes. The answer is adding these microbes, right? Which is kind of, you know, the whole, you know, I don't want to say what was wrong with science, because no one was wrong. No one is wrong in science, right? There's no right or wrong in science. It all works or it all fails, but there's no right and wrong. Okay. So if you look at, you know, Louis Pasteur was all about sterilizing, right? And he was all about find the bug causes the disease, kill the bug, your disease is gone. However, What he didn't realize is when you follow that patient that you killed that initial bug, other problems start occurring. And that's where, if you look at the other side, which was Antoine Bichon, who, by the way, lived in the late 90s, he was all about, it's not the bug, it's the health of the individual. It's the terrain. It's how healthy is your body to get exposed to that bug and survive. And of course, so which one is right, right? Is it Louis? Is it Antoine? If you go in the middle lane, you go, you know what? Louis, Dr. Pasteur, Pasteur was right. And Bichon was right because it's together, right? One microbe doesn't just sit by itself. It sits on an island of other microbes. So that microbe, whatever you do, affects the terrain, right? The terrain affects the microbe as well. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's really in the middle. It's looking at those two brilliant scientists and saying, okay, well, Pasteur was right. We need to kill that bug that's overgrown. But Bichon was also right because we need to maintain the environment to allow for the fighting of that bug, right? So that's where I stand. I stand in the microbiome tells the story. We've killed enough. And if we're going to kill, we need to reboost. You can't. And the problem is, and I compare this, the microbiome to a transmission of a car. Most people don't realize that the transmission of a car is 880 pieces when you open it together. That log in your toilet is trillions of bacteria, fungus, viruses, parasites, all mixed in together with some fiber, with some nutrients, with everything, right? So that's what you see in your toilet. Now, in the transmission, if you break that little piece, you could fix that little piece probably, but then you're going to break five more pieces. And then you're going to need to fix the other five and the other five. Eventually, the whole transmission needs to be fixed. And then are you going to take a transmission of a Honda and put it in a Mercedes? So it's the same concept of fecal transplant, right? You're seeing that log in the toilet. Pretty soon you're giving it some antibiotics. You just killed a whole bunch of microbes. Now you can fix that microbe and kind of bring back those microbes you destroyed, but then you're destroying other microbes you're never really recreating the balance. It's all about balance. And we don't teach that enough. And if you think of medicine is the scale because it's all about balance. We don't look at that in medicine when we should be looking at balance. We should be saying, okay, people, you know, criticize me because I question alkaline water, because this whole fad of alkaline water to me is crazy. And I have to ask the question, you're healthy, your body is healthy, you're in perfect balance, your pH is okay, your pH is in your stomach is okay, your pH in your small bowel is okay, your pH in your colon is okay. Now you're drinking a gallon of alkaline water. What is that doing to your balance of your system? Your body's constantly going, wait a minute, alkalinity, give it acid. Because our bodies are programmed to do the opposite, right? Our brain is saying, oh, she gave me too much acid. I got to neutralize by giving it alkaline, right? That's what our bodies are made for. If you don't utilize the principles or the physiology of your own body, you're destroying that transmission. And then good luck finding a transmission that was like you to match your own engine that you were before the whole transmission being broken. So that's how you have to kind of look at, you know, people want fecal. They're like, oh my God, I want fecal transplant. This is, you know, the new era. I want this. I want that. Stop looking at the grass as greener on the other side. Focus on your grass and start watering your grass, okay? That's the number one thing that I'm going to teach people. Because people come to me all the time for fecal transplant that I cannot do because you're right. The government only allows us to do fecal transplant for C. diff. Why? Because the government takes the position that we're playing with microbes and microbes are dangerous, as we've seen with COVID. And, you know, their position is do no harm. You know, I personally think that if you're a physician that's been doing fecal transplant and you know what you're doing, the government should not have to tell me how to do fecal transplant. I actually, you know, I find it, you know, and a lot of my colleagues and I always, you know, are, you know, questioning when we get questioned on fecal transplant, because we're like, we're the ones doing it. And here we're getting advice on how to do it, but we're the ones doing it, right? We're the ones playing with the boob. We're the ones seeing the success. Not all of us have the luxury to write the data. You know, I can tell you I'm 52 papers behind. I don't have time to write all my data on and to analyze. It takes a team of scientists. It takes a team of bioinformatics, statisticians, you know, even editors, writers, etc. It's a team to really write the data. That's where pharmaceutical companies have the upper hand, because they have those teams structured to write
the data for them. Financing for their own. Yeah,
and that's what we lost medicine to, by the way. We lost medicine because doctors innovate, they write their data, they publish it. Some pharma company sees an idea, says, oh, wait a minute, let me patent that, because the doctor never thought to patent his idea. And then they patent it, and then next thing you know, they have control of the product and the idea. And the doctor who innovated is out of the loop. So, and I see that over and over and over again. Also, I see, you know, doctors that write the idea, they patent it, but then they sell it for like nothing to pharmaceutical companies who basically take it on and then make it a product and never acknowledge the physician who it came from to begin with. So, you know, it's an interesting world that we live in.
No, it really is.
All doctors to patent their ideas and hold on to those patents.
Right.
Because that's your problem.
They're so busy helping people by figuring these things out that they, you know, because I was told by a doctor the other day when I was telling him that I know several functional medicine doctors, many of whom are MDs, who I've seen people reverse people's MS, help reverse their ALS, help reverse anything autoimmune. And he's like, well, it's their responsibility to be writing up their research. I'm like, they're too busy helping their patients. And it all comes down to the microbiome. What are they really doing?
I'll tell you, we cannot advance. You cannot produce a movie if you don't write the screenplay, right? Then the story doesn't get told. So someone taught me that, because I was that busy physician, right? I was that busy physician that was achieving improvement with fecal transplant or other things, and especially my case of Alzheimer's, right? Had I not written that case is now quoted by a lot of doctors and scientists as being the eye opener to, hey, maybe there's something in the microbiome and getting away from the brain. Now, I'm not saying that Alzheimer's is not a brain problem. By no means. It's probably all connected, and it could be brain is primary, brain to gut is primary, or gut is primary, or all of the above, or all connected. Bottom line is that case opened the eyes of neurologists to say, wait a minute, we missed the gut. We should have like thought, yes, the gut, the brain, the blood is circulating through the brain, through the gut. Everything travels in the blood. We have microbes traveling in the blood. We have nerves that are traveling. They're traveling. They're spreading, you know, they're transmitting or bringing microbes to the brain. So that's how we have to look at it. So it really, you know, yeah, nobody is busier than I am. Nobody.
Oh, my God.
I'm conducting clinical trials for pharmaceutical companies. I'm conducting clinical trials for myself, 57 clinical trials on the microbiome and disease. I'm running 4 different companies. I'm you know, helping with a nonprofit. I'm helping with 2 nonprofits, actually. Documenting Hope is another, you know, passion project of mine. I'm there helping everybody. I helped during COVID. I helped during fires, you know, but I still, you know, someone told me at the beginning of the pandemic, because I was coming out with my protocols, and someone said, look, Sabine, if you don't write your data, nobody's going to respect what you're doing. And 40 papers later, in 4 years, I wrote my data, right? So you, and I had a lot of help, right? It's not just Sabine Hazen, but Sabine Hazen is like the hurricane that kind of like is spinning this wheel and this wheel and this wheel, right? And at the end, it all happens. You just have to structure your time to say, look, I'm not going to just take care of patients. I'm going to give 2 days a week to structure patients. I'm going to do 1 day a week to write. I'm going to do 1 day to raise fundings and everything, and then 1 day to administer, whatever. You've got to structure your life. So to all those doctors who achieve, you know, results, functional medicine, please write the data. I'll be happy to help them write the data if they have success. And they have like markers that we can show that they improve. Think about a kid with autism. Well, it's not okay to just say, well, the kid spoke. You have to do a CARS testing to show me that his CARS improved, right? Which is a questionnaire that family does over the period of the time of treatment to say, hey, the kid went from 55 to like 20. He's improving, right? You have to do another questionnaire, which is looking at his sensory, you know, you have to do another questionnaire to look at speech, right? Because you gotta have, you know, markers to kind of see. And then you have to do the data on the microbiome. It's not okay. You know, what I find very frustrating in medicine right now in the world is everybody's coming out with their little product or whatever, and they're saying, this is great for the microbiome. Well, where's the data? Show me the data. What do you mean it's great? What is it improving, right? When I came out with vitamin C and vitamin D and zinc, I knew, you know, from the in vitro studies that vitamin C increased bifidobacteria. When I did it, when I took it on me and I did the before and after microbiome analysis, I saw, hey, vitamin C did increase my bifidobacteria. Vitamin D did increase my bifidobacteria because I was the guinea pig. So I was kind of testing back and forth. These are expensive studies, but this is why we need support. You know, this is why I created the Microbiome Research Foundation to help establish these guidelines, but kind of, you know, areas that people can count on, right? That can say, look, I tested the microbiome at baseline before and after. And I saw, you know, in 20 patients that took vitamin C, I saw an increase in bifidobacteria. That's something you can kind of say, oh, now, is that increase in vitamin C, does it continue after I stop the vitamin C? That's where persisting studies are important. And then, are you increasing the bifidobacteria in everyone? What happens to the people you're not increasing it in? What are they taking that's killing their bifidobacteria, right? So I think that's when you get into the microbiome, when you get into fecal transplant, when you get into anything in research, you really have to have these, you know, endpoints that we call them, right? Primary and secondary endpoint. What are you looking at to change, to say that your product worked? That, you know, I hear, you know, well, I'm going to give the example of melatonin again, but I hear people saying, oh, melatonin is great for COVID. What's your endpoint? Well, how did you do the study? What population did you take? You know, those are because, again, just because it worked on you and coincidentally it worked doesn't mean it's going to work for everybody. That's where the whole placebo control trial came on, right? But the problem is we've gotten so far with these placebo control trials where pharma is like, you know, kind of, you know, I don't want to say playing the data, but making it like where basically it's, hey, it's placebo control or nothing, that we forget to look at the end of one where we succeeded. And we should go back and say, wait, why did the placebo, you know, this was one thing during the pandemic. Dr. Boulware did these studies that were sponsored by Bill Gates on hydroxychloroquine and it failed. And then he did the other study on ivermectin and it failed. And here I am losing no one on the pandemic. And I'm using these components, right? Now I'm using these components for a certain population. There were inclusion criteria that I wrote the protocol inclusion and exclusion criteria, primary endpoint, secondary endpoint. These were the things. That's what I spent my first month of the pandemic doing, was writing 7 protocols. It turned out that I ran 3 protocols. Of course, we ran out of money to finish these protocols. And then the 2 drugs were killed because the opposition wanted a product that was, you know, from one narrative that was heavily funded and killed the 2 drugs. Now, I talked to Dr. Boulware to ask the question. I said, did you give hydroxy on an empty stomach? Did you give ivermectin on a fatty meal? You know, there were a lot of things that when I looked at his data and his protocol, I said, well, no wonder that failed. That would have never worked. You know, ivermectin on an empty stomach, it worked with fatty meal. You know, even the studies that were done by Merck showed that it worked with a fatty meal, right? When I gave it on an empty stomach to my patients whose oxygen dropped in the 70s, it didn't work. It didn't increase the oxygen. You know, I was watching these patients. I stayed with them on the phone with my cell phone, with the monitor, saying, why isn't it going up? Something's up. That's when I discovered, hey, you're drinking alkaline water with that ivermectin. Stop that. Go drink, you know, water regular from the tap, right? Or, hey, you're on an empty stomach. Go have a pizza. Go have a hamburger. Go have French fries. You know, that's how essentially it started, you know, the discovery, right? That's how discoveries occur. And then if it doesn't raise the oxygen, then you have to say, why didn't it raise? What is my patient doing that's worse? Is my patient morbidly obese? You know, because if my patient's morbidly obese, I should be giving a lot more, right? So, you know, so this is how discovery happens, right? Discovery happens by curing one, improving one, you move on to the second and the third and the fourth. And let me tell you, 1,000 patients later, that's why I'm speaking here, 1,000 plus patients later. That's why I'm speaking here, not because I'm the greatest scientist or whatever, but I'm not. I'm here to say, look, I've been doing clinical trials for pharma for 30 years. The one thing I know how to do is clinical trials, okay? I've never had a 483 by the FDA until I did a clinical trial with ivermectin because I was so busy, I forgot to submit a form to the IRB on time. And, you know, rightfully so, you know, the agent said to me, I cannot unsee that, Dr. Hazen. And I said to her, I expect you not to unsee that because you're right. I should have submitted that form. But there's only one of me and there was no income and I was juggling every single hat, taking care of 52 patients, taking care of these protocols, taking care of the regulatory board, losing coordinators in the midst of it. So at some point I was the coordinator at the same time. These were challenging times that I would not wish on anybody. I did it. It was painful to do it. But you know what I learned? I learned that I lost no one, and there was a stratification that I did. And that stratification allowed me to lose no one because I learned from every patient why my patient was not improving oxygen. I added something else, and I learned something else at that point, right? Because you learn from the mistakes, but you keep trying. The problem we did with this pandemic is we said, I'm sorry to kind of go off tangent. That's fine. But the problem with this pandemic is that we assumed everybody was the same and we gave everybody the same guidelines and everybody kind of followed these guidelines that was not necessarily working for them. And I'm a huge believer of if something works for you, just stick to it. You know, if you believe that the vaccine saved you, then stick to that. I'm not here to discredit or to kill the industry or to kill the person that's doing it or to, you know, discredit their freedom of choice. If you believe vitamins helped you, if you believe ivermectin helped you, whatever it is that kept you going, then stick to it. It's your life, your choices, your body. So that's fecal transplant.
Yeah, I know you have to go in 1 minute. I need to ask you one more question back to fecal transplant. I'm pretty sure that in order to be a donor, there's very, very specific parameters. You talked about how depressed people got happy, suicidal people got unsuicidal. I've heard that if you implant the fecal matter of an overweight person, the recipient will become overweight and vice versa. So in terms of weight loss, it sounds better than Ozempic.
But we're not there yet. So data's running. Jessica Allegretti at John Hopkins is at Harvard, actually, is doing amazing work on that. She was part of doing the studies on the mice, skinny mice to fat mice and fat mice to skinny mouse. I recommend you to follow her. She's brilliant. There's a lot of doctors doing a lot of great things with fecal transplant. We're not there yet. I can tell you myself, my patients, I'm a Malibu physician. So all my colleagues kind of joke with me because they're like, well, you're in a different category. Because yeah, my patients come to me and they're like, they're singers. And they're like, is my donor a singer? I'm like, no, your donor is not a singer. Or I have these comedians. Is my donor a comedian? No, your donor is not a comedian. Am I supposed to go on an app to start a dating system to like match the singers with the singers and the musicians and the no. So yes, we're at the beginning. You're going to swap one thing for another. Just figure out. And that's why screening of donors is very important. If you're going to a bank and they're basically paying their donors and they're not screening, they're not doing a questionnaire, that's a mistake. The reason I love Alex Karutz and his lab is because he's meticulous at screening the donors. Dr. Barodi as well, meticulous at screening the donors. It's very important to screen the donors because you got to make sure the patient's not suicidal. Because now you're getting the same thing that improves suicide can cause suicide.
Okay, it's so fascinating. So I know you need to go. My last quick question is, what does spirituality mean to you?
Spirituality to me means everything. Faith is all we have. I start with the foundation that there is a God, that there is a divine presence, that we're just tiny little specks doing our jobs like little worker bees. But there is a divine force that is guiding us, that is bringing us together to rebalance the world, to rebalance the planet. The foundation of science to me starts with God, starts with divine intervention because essentially we can't explain where we come from, And when you get into the microbiome, when you see these trillions of microbes that are all working together and you realize the power of God, you realize, wow, somebody was behind that created that perfectly. And until, a human can show me they can reproduce blood or a human from scratch, from dirt, then I'm going to keep believing that there's a divine force, because that divine force is basically the reason behind the action and the reason behind the reaction. Action leads to reaction no matter what we do. And the reason behind the action and the reason behind the reaction to me is divine intervention for a bigger purpose. And, it may not be of our lives to understand it. It could be, we are just we're just here for a small moment to do something bigger for the world in the future. So I think we need to look at the planet, be humble that we're just here for a bunch of years and for a mission. My path is understanding the microbiome. I asked God when I was 5 years old, where do we go after we die? And he brought me to the microbiome. And actually the microbiome, when you look at it, is those microbes in your gut that decompose your body and put you back into the earth. So those microbes are still alive and going back into the earth. And then it gets reorganized somehow in the planet. So when you think of the planet, you think of the whole crust, the whole inside, are just microbes all creating that balance. When you think of earthquakes, when you think of climate changes, when you think of everything, it's that imbalance of the planet of microbes that is creating that. We need to bring back the planet in balance, and we need to, you know, destroy less, and we need to heal. That's my opinion right now. And so the microbiome to me is a look into the possibilities, a look into hope, a look into divine, into God. So faith is everything. I wouldn't have been standing, you know, during the pandemic, I wouldn't have stepped into a fire to help my neighbors bring supplies if I didn't have faith. I wouldn't have stepped in to help, to go into my clinic taking care of patients with COVID without a mask, because we didn't have a mask at the beginning, if I didn't have faith. And that faith, those prayers I do, you know, really help me, and really, it's grounding. It's grounding because it allows you to realize how little you are in the planet. And even though you get to that level where people are listening to you and you've got all these followers and fame and everything, it's really nothing if you don't have, if you're not balanced and don't realize that at any moment you could disappear. And then it doesn't matter that you had followers and you had money and you had fame. None of it matters. You're here one day, you're gone the next. You have to deal with yourself. You come alone, you leave alone, and you have to deal with yourself, realizing that you have to do the right thing for humanity. So I work for God. That's it. I'm not, you know, humans don't scare me. Viruses don't scare me. I trust God to put me on this path for a reason, and I'm going to follow that path.
That was one of the most fantastic. I mean, everybody's answer is beautiful, but that's really one of the most fantastic answers I've heard. I loved everything you said. So last quick thing is, where can people find you?
From Jenna Biome, all our publications are there. All our news, our podcast, your podcast, send it to me so I can put it up there. Sure. You know, I've done a lot over the last 4 years. You know, I've done a lot of conferences. I go to a lot of different conferences. So everything is on Progena Biome. We try to use that as a site to educate people. So I encourage people to register. I encourage people to ask questions there. I'm always the one answering. I'm about 1,000 emails behind because I'm juggling a lot. But, you know, I try to answer everybody.
Okay, that's fantastic. And I'm going to link your social media. I like looking at your Instagram. I like the things you've been putting up. So I'm going to link
that. Thank you.
So thank you so much for taking the time. I know how busy you are, and this was so fantastic. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And by the way, big kiss to your mom. Tell her thank you for following me and supporting me. I appreciate moms more than you know.
I will. She's going to love that. Hey guys, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about In the Now Wellness. You guys are going to be hearing in this episode from Lily and Aron, who came at us with an incredible extra with some great insights. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about what she does in this company that she's created. And so In the Now Wellness uses the foundational concepts of Lev Emunah Therapy. And it's focused on helping a person to lift the confusion, doubt, and fear in their lives by introducing their physical self to their higher self. So often our physical self carries the heavy weight of ensuring that we experience pleasantness and safety in life. However, our higher self, the part of us that was created in the image of God, is very powerful and a magnet to all that we need in life. Instead of using our physical self or force or desperately chasing something, one can learn to let go of the fears and doubts that cover our higher self. Through that process, we can allow those things that we need to show up in our lives in miraculous ways. Some might call this mazal or luck, but what it really is us tapping into the part of ourselves that was given to us by God and learning how to use it to create the life that we want, a life of pleasantness and ease. Life doesn't have to be difficult. It doesn't have to be unmanageable or out of control. It can actually be quite wonderful. And if you're ready to begin creating the life you've always wanted and letting go of the blocks and resistance that you've held on to most of your life, In the Now Wellness is ready to help you do that. So guys, I've attached a link to Lillian's website at the end of our show notes as well. And please feel free to go and check it out. She's worked with, definitely a bunch of people that I know, and people have been very, very happy. And she's just an incredible person to be around. So I hope you guys will check her out. I have with me as my second guest on this episode about fecal transplant, Saffron Cassidy. Saffron directed her first documentary feature film called Cyber Seniors in 2014. The film followed a group of senior citizens as they learned about the internet from teenage mentors and the connections made both on and offline. The film has been broadcast in 40 countries, including on PBS, Netflix, and CBC in North America. Cyber Seniors screening events were supported by over 900 partners, including AARP Foundation, Best Buy Foundation, Blue Cross Blue Shield, MN, and hundreds of schools, universities, and libraries. In her new film, Designer Shit, Saffron explores the efficacy of fecal transplant for her condition, ulcerative colitis, using herself as a human guinea pig. So first of all, I'd like to welcome you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
You as well. So when I decided that I wanted to do an episode on fecal transplant, I did what I guess any normal person would do in 2023. And I just did a search on Instagram for the hashtag fecal transplant to see what would come up. And one of the first things that came up was Saffron and her page, which I believe is of the same name, correct? I think it's Designer Shit, but it's spelled like with dollar signs or something like that. And you were one of the first things, one of the first people to come up. So I reached out to you at that time.
We've been working on the film for about 5 years. So we've been posting online, but you know, we're just officially coming out now. So we're so happy when people are kind of finding us organically like that.
Yeah, so I was excited to see that. I actually believe we are speaking tonight, and for the next 3 days, people are going to miss this free online screening because by the time this comes out, it will be too late. But you are doing a screening, and I know you're going to be doing a live Q&A as well in a couple of days. And I understand this movie is actually about you.
It is, yeah. I'm a filmmaker and I'm also an IBD patient. I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis in my early 20s. I'm in my mid 30s now, so it's been a while. And when I was first diagnosed, my condition was described as mild. It moved up to more moderate over the years. And when I was first diagnosed, I was put on medication that worked really well for me. It was kind of a mild medication, 5-ASA medication. It had very little side effects, and it got me into remission, and I was happy on that medication until it stopped working. And then I just kind of got into this period of never quite being able to get into remission, and I started thinking, you know, how am I going to get this under control so that it doesn't affect the next decade of my life the way it's been affecting me now? I had heard about fecal transplant. I was curious about fecal transplant, and I went down this road of trying to figure out if this could be a solution for me.
And who did you turn to? Did you go to a gastro? Was there, you didn't do one at home, right? It wasn't one. We did not talk about that with Dr. Hazen, but I've heard that people have tried this at home. I don't know, swallowing pills, making their own pills.
I did do fecal transplant at home.
Oh, did you really? Okay, can you tell us about that then?
Yeah, the documentary follows my journey doing DIY fecal transplant at home using my husband as my stool donor. So my interest in fecal transplant began, I met a friend of a friend who had done it himself. I had kind of heard of it, but never really took it seriously because it sounded kind of snake oily. But he had done it himself using his mother as his donor. He was suffering from severe Crohn's disease. He was in and out of hospital and had miraculous results. And I obviously heard his story firsthand, and it gave me, you know, a glimmer of hope. And I thought, God, what if it could work for me that way? Then I did a deep dive into the research and realized that there are some promising results. There's a lot of fecal transplant trials going on. So for my condition, ulcerative colitis, they're finding that after 8 weeks of fecal transplant, about 30% of patients reach remission, which sounds low, but it's actually kind of on par with biologic medication, which is the common medication for my condition. So, you know, I knew that my results probably weren't going to be as good as this person that I met. He was an outlier and I had to be realistic about my expectations, but there was a 30% chance that this could possibly work for me. Unfortunately, there was no way for me to access this treatment at the time. It's in North America, I'm in Canada, but Canada and the US is the same thing right now. It's under clinical investigation, which means there are a lot of clinical trials doing studies on fecal transplant, but I didn't live near one. So, and I broached it with my doctor and kind of asked, this is something I'm interested in. Would you be able to help me? And he just admitted, you know, I really don't know that much about this. I really haven't heard much about it. I don't really feel comfortable helping you do this. So I decided to do it on my own.
Okay, so how'd you do it? Can you tell us, or would that spoil the movie?
I can tell you, and it is shown in the film. First step was finding an eligible donor. And to be a fecal transplant donor, you have to be a health superstar. The kinds of people they're using in these clinical trials have no history of any kind of illness, really no history of antibiotic use, preferably breastfed, vaginally delivered, really healthy diet, obviously no bowel-related problems, regular bowel movements every day. And my partner, my boyfriend at the time, he happens to be my husband now, actually met all this criteria. He just happens to be an extremely healthy person, has been his entire life. And I asked him if he would be willing to donate to me. And he said yes. He actually jumped at the opportunity because, you know, as someone who was living with a person suffering from ulcerative colitis, he saw firsthand how this was affecting my life. And he just thought, if there's any way I can help, I would love to. So we went ahead and got him tested. Now, the testing they do in these clinical trials is way more intense than the testing that was available to us. We were told that there's less of a risk because we are intimate partners who share a home, who share a bathroom. So some of the risks associated with fecal transplant is obviously transferring a bacterial infection, blood-related illnesses. You know, it's not foolproof, but when it is an intimate partner, you kind of, you know those risks already. So we did get his stool tested. From there, I mean, the process is relatively straightforward and just as gross as you think it would be. I would get a sample from my husband in the morning. He would put it in a bowl and wrap it in a Ziploc bag and another Ziploc bag. And then I would go into the bathroom and I would put it into a blender with some saline solution, blend it into a slurry, which I would put into an enema bottle and insert it into my rectum and hold it in for about an hour. And I did that a lot. I did it about 200 times over the course of 2 years.
Oh my gosh. Wow. So this wasn't like one and done. This was like, wow. Okay.
I think I really hoped going into this that this would be a magic bullet cure, that a fecal transplant is something that you do one time and you're cured of ulcerative colitis forever. And I will say that when it comes to C. difficile, those are the types of results that we're seeing. It's incredibly effective for C. difficile. It usually takes one transplant, maybe two, and usually it gets rid of C. difficile for good. What we're seeing with ulcerative colitis is we don't have a true method yet for determining like how many are needed over what period of time. Is it better to do one every 2 weeks? Is it better to do one every single day for 2 weeks? So this person I knew who had done it himself, he followed the method of doing it every day for a month, every other day for a month, every third day for a month. And then he would wean off. And if his symptoms came back, he would go right back to the beginning every day for a month. So that's what I did.
Okay. How long ago was this?
This was, I think I started in the beginning of 2018.
And then have you had to go back and do any of this again after your 2 years?
What happened is after doing it every day for about 2 weeks, the first time I went into remission, it worked very well and quite quickly. But as I weaned off, my symptoms came back. So that's why I kept doing it. And after 2 years, I got to a point where my symptoms had dramatically improved, but there was still a little bit of inflammation. And I show this in the film, that if you look at my colonoscopy results before and after, there's a huge improvement, but you still see a little bit of inflammation in my rectum that I couldn't get rid of. And then I got pregnant. So I stopped doing fecal transplant once I got pregnant. But something about pregnancy knocked me into remission. So for me, I do believe that the fecal transplants helped. They didn't get me 100% into remission. It was a combination of fecal transplant, pregnancy. This happened during COVID. I was pregnant during COVID. So it was a time in my life where I was able to just kind of not stress out about social situations and work situations where I was always panicked about where the bathroom is. It was, I always say, the perfect storm that got me sick in the first place. It was this perfect calm. So I do believe that fecal transplant helped, but it was in combination with a few other things.
Yes. So it's actually very common, even with like people who have MS and different things like that, that when they're pregnant, they often go into remission as well. So that in itself is not uncommon. Can I ask you a couple of questions? Maybe if they're too personal, I can cut, I can whatever. Are you someone who has more of a higher level of anxiety or stress or things like that? Because my understanding is often people with a lot of gut issues do have just more of that type of personality.
I probably do, but I will say that after suffering from ulcerative colitis for about 5 years, once my medication stopped working, my stress and anxiety levels went up. Yes. And I think I was dealing with a certain degree of, PTSD, because I had just been in situations before where I almost didn't make it to the bathroom on time. And now I was faced with these situations where if I was ever, stuck in a traffic jam in my car, or even in line at the grocery store waiting to pay, any situation where I was like, this would be a horrible time for me to have to run to the bathroom, I would start panicking that I had to go to the bathroom. And it would often make me need to go to the bathroom. So it was just this constant cycle of I call them my triggers. I was being triggered every single day, and I was under a lot of stress.
No, I believe that exactly that. It becomes this like loop that you can't get out of. So I believe that. Okay. So I have to ask you another interesting question, because I did ask Dr. Hazen this as well. My understanding from things I've read and things I've heard are that the reason the person has to be the super healthy person is that often the recipient will take on the characteristics of the donor. So have you noticed like any changes in anything just because you...
No, I think that that's really interesting. And I get asked this question a lot. I don't have any anecdotes like that where I don't think, my husband is like we talked about, I was like a very stressed out kind of anxious person. My husband is one of those people who just like jumps out of bed in the morning, like sunshine following him around. Like he's just like this happy-go-lucky guy that I really thought, I'm like, maybe, I'll have this like mood shift and it'll be great. But no, I think I've stayed kind of the same. I'm just feeling healthier. But I have heard interesting anecdotes. In our film, we have one person who did fecal transplant with his mother as a donor, and he was wondering why he kept having these hot flashes and mood swings. Well, his mother was going through menopause at the time, so he believes that there was some sort of hormonal transfer going on. So you hear little anecdotes like that, and it's very interesting because it shows, what kind of things are being controlled in our bowels and our microbiomes that can be transferred and manipulated through this kind of procedure. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about that as we study this process more.
It is unbelievably fascinating, which is why I wanted to present this as one of the episodes. Did you try like an anti-inflammatory diet in conjunction with this? I mean, I'm probably talking about something that you probably tried 100 times and everybody yelled about that.
In terms of diet, when I was really suffering from ulcerative colitis, the diet that helped me was the specific carbohydrate diet, which is cutting out all grains, all sugar, most dairy. It's a very restrictive diet. It worked really well to get me into remission, but it was not a good diet long term. I was really thin, I was always hungry. I had low iron. Like, I was just like, so yeah, that was the diet that worked for me. And then after doing fecal transplant, I was able to add in more carbohydrates and grains. And now I really focus on, now that I'm feeling well, I try to more so focus on a high fiber diet with a lot of, you know, prebiotic fiber and resistant starch to feed the healthy microbiome that I currently have.
It would be really interesting to know if fecal transplant would change the microbiome of like someone with celiac, right? Because like you're saying, you're able to tolerate more grains now. Maybe that's because your husband can tolerate more grains.
Yeah, perhaps. I'm sure that there are tons of trials going on for celiac right now. The complicated part is, which donor is the right donor for celiac versus which donor is the right donor for colitis? Can we isolate the specific microbes that are good for those conditions and turn it into something that's less disgusting than the way that I did it?
Well, I think
it was just a pill that was specifically like the exact bacteria in my husband's stool that I needed. I would have much preferred to have taken that instead of the whole stool sample.
So some of the things I read, people were putting into pills and swallowing the pills. I mean, as gross and as horrible as that sounds. So that's why I wasn't sure how you actually did it, because I did actually read that literally people were swallowing, like putting into gelatin capsules and swallowing it. So
I have heard of people doing that. For me, with ulcerative colitis, the medication that we tend to take is you take the same medication orally and rectally. So I have the same drugs that are in a pill that I take morning and evening and then in a rectal suppository. And the rectal suppository is always more effective for me because the inflammation is right at the bottom. It's like right in my rectum. So when it came to fecal transplant, it made sense to me to put it right there, as opposed to having it go all the way through my digestive tract and maybe you're losing some stuff along the way.
Yeah.
But I do think in North America, the FDA would like to see this be turned into a pill form because they think it's easier to control that way. So there's different theories on which method is better, but
doesn't I was comfortable me.
With the enema. Yeah.
Doesn't can bottle it and sell it. Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the movie?
Sure. So the movie shows my life with ulcerative colitis, and it follows my journey as I set out to learn as much as I can about fecal transplant. I interview some of the, you know, the top researchers in the world from Canada, the US. We have an Australian. These are microbiologists, gastroenterologists who are involved in clinical trials. And through meeting them, I decide to do fecal transplant on my own. I don't inform my doctor. The entire time I'm doing it, I'm kind of oscillating between risk versus benefit. Was this a good idea? In the end, I come clean to my doctor and we have an honest conversation about it. And it turns into a film that's, you know, it's really about patient empowerment and, you know, taking control of your own health, being your own healthcare advocate, making intelligent decisions and questioning whether or not doing DIY fecal transplant was an intelligent decision. And I'm not recommending anybody else does it that way, but I present my reasons for why I felt it was right for me at that time in my life.
I love it because that's what I'm trying to do here on this podcast, is encourage people to be their own health advocate and to listen and to learn about everything and then make your decision about what is right for you from a place of knowledge, as opposed to just being spoken to that this is the only way.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a scene at the beginning of the film where I have a conversation with my doctor. And because, like I said, my condition was always considered mild to moderate, he deals with people with severe ulcerative colitis who, you know, have had surgeries to get their colons removed. And he says, your life isn't that severely impaired, is it? And I think in my own head, well, you know, I'm on all these medications. It's costing me $500 a month. They're still not working that well. I'm running in and out of the bathroom 10 times a day sometimes. But then what do I say to him? I go, yeah, no, my life isn't that severely impaired. These conversations we have with doctors sometimes where, you know, they're not fully understanding the day-to-day stress that you're under or the pain that you're in. Maybe sometimes we as patients aren't expressing ourselves that well to our doctors or demanding to be heard like we should be. So yeah, it was something that I really thought about as I made this film and watched myself back on camera of like, why wasn't I speaking up about my needs more?
I think that is great. I think it's great for people to see. I think it's great for people to hear. And I love it. So where can people watch the film? Where can people get in touch with you? And I'm going to ask you a funny question. I did this in a different order, but I'm going to ask you a funny question that I probably didn't prepare you for, but I'm going to ask you the same question I ask all my other guests. After you tell me where we can find you.
Okay, well, our website is designershitdocumentary.com. The film will be released in the U.S. November 14th. But if you go on our website and sign up for our newsletter or follow us on social media, you'll get updates on where else it might be released when it's coming to your country. And yeah.
Okay, great. And we will definitely, please God, put this out before November 14th just to make sure that people hear about it, you know, so that people can see the movie. So the question that I like to ask all of my guests, and I probably didn't prepare you for this because I was looking at it as the addendum to the initial health expert, is what does spirituality mean to you?
That's a tough question. It is something that I've thought about on this journey because I had such moments of doubt throughout this journey of why am I doing this? Why am I putting out there? But this out there. But sometimes when I was able to calm my mind and be in nature and just get into this receptive space, answers came to me so clearly. And it came to me in a sense of knowing that everything I am doing right now, this difficult journey that I'm going through, is for a reason. And there is an end in sight. There was a few key moments along this journey. They all happened to be outside and in nature, which I think means something. And I, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I do kind of look to nature for answers. And just having that sense of hope and feeling that you're being cared for and really believing in yourself that this is possible for me. It's kind of what got me through this whole thing.
Well, I fully agree with you. That's the one thing that several people, you know, several different doctors, people that I've had on have said, is that you have to have hope. You know, one person called it vitamin H. If you don't have hope, then you're never going to get better because if your brain thinks that you're never going to get better, then you're not going to get better. Mm-hmm. So I've said before, I haven't said it to you, so many people have heard me say this before, but that you don't have to be religious to be spiritual. And most people have some sense of spirituality. It comes to different people in different ways. And that's fantastic. And that's why I like to hear, you know, what each person connects with. Mm-hmm. Thank you so, so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was nice chatting with you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Holy Health. It's been a while. This is one of the first extras that I'm recording in a very long time, thanks to this ongoing war here in Israel. But we've decided the time is right to get back to doing what we love to do, what we love to hear about. So I am here today with my friend Lillian Aharon. Lillian is a facilitator of Lev Emunah Therapy. She learned under Rabbi Rachamim Biton. She has a degree in English and Communications from Touro College, works as a graphic designer, and she's also published a children's book. And she and I have been talking about this. The second I told her about this episode with Dr. Hazen on fecal transplant, she right away started spewing things. And I said, I want you to do the Torah extra for me. So we're here today. I can't wait to hear what she's got for us. And I can't wait, frankly, for you guys to hear this episode. It's been a long time in coming. Although this just goes to show how out of the loop I am, because you guys will have already heard the extra when you will have already heard the episode when you hear this extra. So it goes right to show you how out of the loop I am for not having really recorded in a couple of months. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. And now I'm here with Lillian to give you guys some words of Torah. Take it away.
Sure. Hi. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much. The episode was really, really interesting. I had almost never heard anything about fecal transplant in the past. But one thing that stood out for me is that Dr. Hazen mentions a lot about balance. So balance is happened to be a huge part of Rambam's philosophy. So Rambam was a doctor and a Jewish philosopher, and he passed away in the early 13th century. And what's fascinating to me is that so much of what he said, you know, hundreds of years ago still holds true. So he believed that health was built on three things. So the first is regular bowel movements. The next is discipline to exercise on a regular basis, pretty much every day, like around 20 minutes, and to have restraint against overeating, even overeating healthy food, because he said it's not about the food that you eat, it's about how you're filling up your stomach. And so the foundation of all three of those things is about eliminating properly. And so I said, and I thought to myself, why is eliminating so important to Rambam? And I did learn something pretty interesting. If someone is praying or learning Torah and they have to go to the bathroom, whether it's like eliminating or urinating, they have to stop what they're doing, even in the middle of like Shemona Esrei, like a really big, long point in prayer. They even have to stop and they have to go to the bathroom, and then they can, you know, finish their prayers or their learning. And it's because on a Kabbalistic level, having to eliminate blocks consciousness, which I thought was so fascinating. So it's this idea that that when we're praying, when we're asking, you know, God to answer our prayers, we want to be as open as possible. And if we are closed off from God, then we can't have our prayers answered, and we can't receive in the way that we'd want to receive while learning, while praying. So I thought that was very cool. I did not grow up observant. And when I first started learning about observant Judaism, the first thing I began doing regularly was saying a special prayer for after you go to the bathroom. And it's called Asher Yatzar. And it's something that I thought was super important. I never really learned too much in depth. And so it wasn't until recently that I really came to understand the deep reason of why Asher Yatzar is just so, is so profound. So I'm actually going to read what the English is of Asher Yatzar. It says, "Blessed are you, our God, our Father of the universe, who formed man with wisdom and created within him many openings and hollow spaces. It is obvious and known before your seat of honor that if even one of them would be opened, or if even one of them would be sealed, it would be impossible to survive and to stand before you even for 1 hour. Blessed are you, our God, who heals all flesh and acts wondrously." So, excuse me. That is the blessing that people say after one has eliminated, regardless of what they're eliminating. If they're if they go to the bathroom, then they say this blessing. And it covers a lot, and it's really, really a beautiful blessing. And why at the age of 14, of all the things that I could have chosen that I wanted to be really committed to, it was that, I'm really not sure. But it has been something that's been really meaningful for me most of my life. So, so as I started learning about it, this is what I've uncovered. Essentially, the world around us, we live in a physical world, but the world around us is filled with sparks of holiness. And while we engage in this physical world, we withdraw withdraw with our consciousness the sparks of God from all this chaos around us. So let's take food. When we put food in our mouth, we eat, we chew with our teeth, and our body goes through a separation process, and it separates what the body needs and like what is life energy, and then what is completely not needed. And so whatever is not part of this like light of life thing is processed until it becomes waste, and then it exits our body. And when we eliminate the waste, the whole body is able to ascend to a next level of consciousness. So this is why in the morning, when we get up, one of the first blessings, I think maybe there's like one other blessing. One of the first blessings we say is the blessing for going to the bathroom, Asher Yetzar. So Kabbalistically, over the course of like the nighttime and the last day, we acquire something called klipot. So it's kind of like peel. It's like the word for is peel, or it's husk. And it's like an outer shell. And this basically conceals the light of God. And it conceals, it hides our connection to God. So the first line of the blessing that I said, it says, Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, asher yetzar et adam bechochma. It's blessed are you, God, who created man with wisdom. So Rabbi Nachman says that the chachma part of us, the wisdom part of us, allows us through our eyes to be able to select the sparks of divinity from this physical world. So we're able to look beyond the superficial images that we see and find holiness. So whatever we're like looking at or interacting with or involved with, like food. So when we use our consciousness to acknowledge the life force energy in the food, then we can connect to it and we can magnify it. So the process of selecting these sparks includes ways of keeping the sparks in and then eliminating that which isn't needed. And so this is the part of Asher Yetzar where we thank God for, you know, the holes that should be open should stay open, and the holes that should be closed should stay closed. Because that which isn't like divine or holy or useful to us, it contains something called judgment energy. It's the energy associated with like things like fear and doubt and guilt and shame. And essentially we want to release all that. We don't want to keep that inside of ourselves. So imagine that there is something in our system that is blocking life. If there's something inside of our system blocking life, we would want to eliminate that. And then when we eliminate it, we're able to connect more strongly and closely with the infinite source of life that is within all of us. And all healing in life happens when we remove blocks. And so the blessing of Asher Yetzar is essentially the ultimate healing blessing, because it's all about eliminating that which blocks us from God, and having an open connection to Hashem is the number one way to be healed. So I'm going to drink some water. What's that get? So most of us, I hope, eliminate several times a day, maybe two times, maybe three times, hopefully. And the Chafetz Chaim says that the blessing of Asher Yetzar becomes kind of like a meditation. It's a segula. I don't know how to define Segula. Like, how would you define?
Kind of like a good luck, good thing that will help bring you goodness.
Exactly. So it's like a good luck
thing may be.
To bring healing.
Right.
That, you know, so that someone focuses on their health. Every time they say this blessing, it's like an opportunity to make an affirmation for one's health every single time it's said. And so the idea behind Asher Yetzar is actually the foundation of Lev Emuna therapy, which it was created by Rabbi Rachamim Biton. And it's how I've been trained to help people. So anything that isn't life affirming, any judgment energy, like fear or doubt or anger, guilt or shame, anything that blocks life and vitality of life, we want to sweeten that judgment by releasing it. So, you know, there are therapeutic tools and meditations that they select the sparks of divinity in the world and release that which has to be eliminated. So, you know, we can fully connect with God and manifest a beautiful reality for ourselves. And so I found it pretty interesting how Asher Yetzar and the work that I do with clients are so connected. And I hope that this helped you to understand a little bit more about eliminating, especially from a Torah perspective.
Wow. No, I think that was really great. And I love how it fits in exactly with what you do. And for sure, I think that if people are stuck within themselves, where, like you're saying, there's fear or there's shame or there's judgment, that they tend to like clench everything. And when you're clenching everything internally, I mean, again, I could take it all back to the breathing and the stabilizing system, because that is part of the elimination system. That's part of the limb system, part of a lot of these things that we've spoken about, but you'll stop everything up. Like you can't actually allow things to open. So I think that's really interesting. And I think that was really, really great and really powerful way of putting things together. And I really like it.
So cool. Yeah. You know, the fight or flight response, when we're like super stressed out, it basically stops everything from flowing the way it's supposed to. And so, So I guess, eliminating is also eliminating oxygen when you breathe, you know, there's so much that has to do with eliminating. And then we eliminate that which we don't need so that we can really connect to God. And so I find that really, you know, really inspiring and reassuring that we have that.
Exactly what you say is true. If you're stuck in that fight or flight response, when you breathe diaphragmatically, in addition to the fact that you start to pump the digestive system, because you actually descend the diaphragm down and up, you also stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system, which does the opposite of that fight or flight response. It actually gives you rest and digest. It actually allows you to calm down. And that's how everything, like almost every single topic I've ever covered, like you could connect the dots. Things are connected. And that's why,
I love that.
You know, we can't just usually take one thing. It's like, we want to do as many good, easy things that we can do, because, you know, but you don't have to start with everything. You start with one and you layer on another. And so it really does all relate, because when you breathe well, you will eliminate much better. It'll be much easier and you won't end up with hemorrhoids and things you get from straining. And so it's fascinating. It's really fascinating. And thank you so much. You did a fantastic job. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure. I'm really so excited I was given the opportunity to do this, because, you know, as much as I thought I might have known about Asher Yetzar, until I really went into depth, I didn't really, like, it was just such a great opportunity to learn more. And now I feel even more connected to the blessing. So I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. Please seek guidance from a trusted healthcare professional. By listening to this podcast, you release holy health and any of our guests from all liability. I'd like to thank Joker Productions for editing this podcast.